This is an interview with Kate Fulton for the SEC Historical Society's Virtual Museum and Archive on the History of Financial Regulation. I'm James Stoker. Today is July 6th, 2012. We're talking at Ms. Fulton's office at BlackRock's government offices in downtown Washington, D.C. Ms. Fulton, thanks very much for talking with me today.
I'm happy to be here.
Well, we've got a lot to talk about, so I'll just jump right in. How did you get started in a career doing government relations for financial firms?
Well, I started working right after college at Morgan Stanley in New York. I was in the analyst program, basically in a generalist pool of analysts. Started out in the capital markets area working in private placements. And during my second year, I was a generalist in corporate finance and corporate coverage.
Okay. If you don't mind me going back just a little bit, I know you went to Amherst College.
Right.
Would you mind telling me what you studied there?
I studied political science, but international political science. Had nothing to do with U.S. political issues. And I wrote a thesis on Northern Ireland. So it really was not directly related to what I ended up pursuing for a career.
But, did you take any courses in business or finance or anything like
no,
that?
No, Amherst is a liberal arts college, so it's not a pre-business curriculum. And I didn't take economics. I was really straight down the line liberal arts. But I majored in political science, and I focused on the international issues in that context. So I really didn't take a lot of American government or anything related to American political processes, except for when you and I were just chatting about history. I took a lot of diplomatic history, and so I guess that probably gave me some sense of how things in Washington work, just because how important diplomacy is.
So when you went to do your interview at Morgan Stanley, did they ask you about your background in finance, how well you understand the concepts?
Well, interestingly, I graduated in 1983, and the analyst programs were just getting momentum at that point in the investment banks. My priority after college was to get a job, which is why I didn't really gravitate toward graduate school, although I thought I might eventually attend graduate school. And a lot of companies recruited on campus, and I talked to several, a wide variety, advertising, et cetera. The investment banking positions were very competitive, and they had a lottery. So I didn't think I could make the lottery just by virtue of the fact that I thought that maybe they were seeking economics majors or math majors, et cetera. So what happened for me was that Morgan Stanley was very thorough, and they called the college, and they said, give us some names of people whom we should meet who didn't seek an interview. So I thought that was pretty impressive, and that's how my name made it onto the schedule, and I was the last person on the schedule for both Morgan Stanley and Merrill Lynch, same program.
And then you started as an analyst.
I started as an analyst.
Uh-huh. And how did you move?
And I got offers from both.
Oh, yeah.
So what it became clear to me was what they were seeking was, surely it was great to have people who were math whizzes and economics, had an economics background, but what they were really seeking were people who had a good grasp of a liberal arts background and who could speak and write and get along well with others and juggle a lot of conflicting requirements and work hard, really hard. Yep. So I think those qualities I certainly was able to demonstrate. Mm-hmm. And so it became pretty clear to me that it wasn't the math whiz aspect that was really what they were seeking. They were looking for people who would work well with others and be part of a team, et cetera. So
okay.
So started at Morgan Stanley, capital markets, private placements. There was about 35 or so analysts in my class at that time, and there were people who were very quantitative, and there were people similar to my background, and they put us in suitable positions. So it was wonderful. It was just an incredibly quick immersion,
mm-hmm.
Very supportive, a lot of very smart people, and a very good built-in network of friends because there were so many people right out of college in the same position.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how did you go from being an analyst to working more directly on government affairs?
So during my second year, a lot of people end up going to graduate school, business school. That was the path. And there was a woman who was an analyst in the government affairs group whom I knew, and she asked me if I'd be interested in taking her slot as a third year because some people would stay on. And that appealed to me a lot, just given my interests. So that's how it happened. I ended up interviewing for her position because she had a fellowship after her analyst experience. So she didn't go on to graduate school right away. She ended up getting a fellowship. So it really tapped into what I was most interested in, was the intersection of policy and financial services. So it was a great fit for me personally, just because it really checked a lot of boxes in terms of things I was interested in. And it was a really important spot even then. I mean, it was, I think companies were starting to get very serious about Washington at that point, and a lot of Morgan Stanley's competitors already had substantial offices down here. Goldman Sachs has always had a major office, the money center banks. This was prior to, obviously, prior to the repeal of Glass-Steagall. So the securities industry had a very strong trade association, Securities Industry Association, and Morgan Stanley was active with that.
Right.
So there were a lot of issues right out of the box.
If I can ask you, were you dealing mostly with the Congress, or did you also interact with the SEC, with maybe with the Federal Reserve, other
In those days, it was mostly the Congress. And when I started, Morgan Stanley was very much immersed in their efforts to help Conrail maintain its independence. So while the government affairs function was pretty small, it was my boss and I and a couple of support staff. That's it. It was very small. The privatization of Conrail consumed the effort for the first year or two that I was doing government affairs for Morgan Stanley. I mean, there were tax issues. There were other financial issues. But this was a major corporate priority to help Conrail.
Right.
So I spent most of my first 2 years almost working on Conrail.
I want to ask you about Conrail, but first just let me ask you a general question. I understand that the Government Affairs Office at Morgan Stanley was in New York.
Right.
Was that an obstacle to your work at all because you weren't in Washington and you couldn't just go out to lunch with these people every day?
Well, I think there are different models. And I think ultimately Morgan Stanley decided it was important to be here. So it really wasn't an obstacle for me because I was down here a lot, as was my boss at the time, Bill Harmon. We were constantly on the shuttle coming back and forth. But I do think there's an advantage to being here, yes. Was it a real drawback for Morgan Stanley? I don't think it was a seriously negative drawback. And as I said earlier, at the time, the trade association was extremely strong here. So there was a good bit of dependence on the SIA to help represent Morgan Stanley.
Right. So. Okay. Yeah. Let's talk about the Conrail issue in a little bit more depth. Now, Conrail at this time was, I think, the largest rail company in the United States. And it was owned, I guess, partially by the government at this time, right?
I thought it was, I can't remember, actually. No, I don't think
okay,
at that
maybe
time.
Okay, maybe it wasn't...
Well, wait a minute. There was a pretty long history, and there might have been a government investment in it, but it was not a controlling investment.
Right.
They'd had some troubles, the predecessors to Conrail, prior to the time we were working on it, and it was a north-south freight railroad. Mm-hmm. There were also east-west freight railroads, and at the time, Mrs. Dole was transportation secretary under President Reagan. And she was concerned about Conrail's tortured history, troubled history, and wasn't convinced it could stay alone and be viable on its own.
Right.
And Morgan Stanley, as its investment banker, was championing Conrail's interests in staying independent.
Right.
So she championed an effort to sell Conrail to Norfolk Southern, and Norfolk Southern was very pleased to have that opportunity. So this was all about keeping Conrail independent, and it was one of the early efforts with grassroots activities because the firm and Wexler's firm, Wexler, Reynolds, Harrison, and Shule, created a coalition to keep Conrail independent, and it was one of the early grassroots efforts that included shippers and manufacturers that had an interest in competitive pricing, right? Because you only have one north-south railroad, you won't have...
Yeah. And as part of that, they put together, I guess, a group of investors that would go in and actually purchase the company, right?
Right. There was a syndicate that was created.
Was it Morgan Stanley that put them together?
Well, I'm trying to think. I've got to circle back. I didn't realize you were going to ask me all these questions about Conrail.
No problem.
Because there were different ideas that were floated at different times for how to keep Conrail independent. And as I recall, there was a group of investors. And Norfolk Southern had some too.
Right.
But ultimately, at the end, the shares were sold to the public.
Right.
After the long battle. But I think the investor interest was, and the investor commitments were used to demonstrate that Conrail could be viable on its own.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But it was quite a battle, and it was the whole town was either one side or the other.
Right.
And we were up against the administration.
Mm-hmm.
And this was President Reagan, one of President Reagan's priorities to accomplish this. But it was, as I said, an early case study on how grassroots work and the labor community was really important.
So were you in touch with labor leaders and groups?
I really wasn't
like
the labor. I spent a lot of time with the grassroots efforts.
Uh-huh.
A lot of time on the Hill. Dennis Eckert, Congressman Eckert from Ohio, was a champion who worked with us. Because he had a lot of employees in Ohio who were worried about job loss, because that's the other concern. In addition to shippers, he had labor who were very concerned about what would happen to them if there were only one railroad. And then you had the feeder railroads who had concerns too. So it was a real interesting immersion in the whole railway system in the United States.
Absolutely.
I had no idea how it all worked, and it was fascinating. But it was also a great case study in how Washington works because of all the different interests and allegiances. And a lot of people I met during that period I still am in touch with.
Right.
So it was a really great experience for me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Another issue that was very important for Morgan Stanley in the 1980s was the junk bond market. Now, as I understand it, in 1984, Morgan Stanley started to really get into junk bonds and established a unit on junk bonds. Did that affect your work at all? Were you lobbying?
Well, I didn't really start in government affairs there till 85,
right.
6.
Okay.
85.
Mm-hmm.
85.
Yeah.
But the whole junk bond issue relates pretty closely to the concerns about M&A and hostile takeovers. And as you and I mentioned the other day, Morgan Stanley was involved in an effort with Goldman, Lehman at the time, First Boston, to give some perspective on mergers and acquisitions, and because Congress, as is often the case, was very concerned about hostile takeovers funded by junk bonds,
right.
funded by that. So yes, I was involved in that in the context of it was called the Capital Markets Group, this effort. Bob Rubin was the person for Goldman. Bruce Wasserstein, all these people we're familiar with were central figures at these firms at that time and were active on this issue.
Was this a registered lobbying group, or was it an NGO, or was it just kind of an informal coalition?
No, it was an informal coalition.
Okay.
I don't think they registered as a specific, you might have to recall that the lobbying disclosure requirements were different then.
Right. Oh, that's true.
So we didn't have as many requirements, although all these people were active in Washington and the SIA at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said earlier, Goldman had a pretty established office here. So we collaborated closely with them on a lot of efforts to oppose legislation to limit takeovers or limit the way takeovers are financed.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a particular focus on oil mergers. I don't know if you remember that. But that was a particular area of concern.
Why on oil mergers in particular?
Because I think there was the concern about hostility. There were firms that didn't want to be taken over, so they would go to Congress to try to support themselves in that effort. And then there was the consumer impact of the way there is now with concerns with energy prices in the event there are takeovers. And Morgan Stanley had a lot of clients in the oil space, as did all the other investment banks. So the oil merger issue was a particular focus, which was interesting. And that really came to a head before I started in the group. I think that was 84.
Okay.
Because I really started in 85.
Right.
And the Conrail, as I said, really consumed a lot of our early efforts.
And when you worked on these issues, did you feel like you were really getting into the nitty-gritty of the legislative process? I mean, were you reading draft legislation and making comments on it, or were there other groups that were doing
more
of that?
Well, I was 22 years
right.
old, so I wasn't exactly writing the bills.
Yeah.
But as you probably know, the staff have an inordinate amount of influence, and I spent a lot of time with the staff and learned a lot about the process. I mean, as I said, in college, I really didn't study a lot about how laws are enacted and the different steps they have to go through. So it was a really good education for me to understand the committee process and the different steps that people have to take to move bills through the process in the House and the Senate.
Yeah, how did you learn about this stuff?
Well, I learned it from the staff on the Hill, yeah. And understanding, well, what happens if one bill is different from the other? And they said, we have a conference to reconcile. And, well, how does a conference work, and how are people named to a conference? And what are the rules in the House versus the Senate? And it's a very important area to know before you can understand how laws get enacted. You have to know what the rules are. And you also have to know what the different points are in the process for influencing. So you have the committee process, you have hearings, you have markups, you have amendments and markups, you have House rules, and you have the House Rules Committee, but you don't have a Rules Committee in the Senate, and the rules in the Senate and the House are really different, and on and on and on and on. Mm-hmm. And then you learn all about the budget process, and that was important with Conrail just because of where Conrail fit in the budget mm-hmm. context. And so you talk about the role of OMB and the fact that OMB has to review everything the administration moves, and there has to be cost-benefit analysis and all that. So that was a whole education, too, in terms of understanding mm-hmm. how OMB worked,
right.
which is a really important
mm-hmm.
function. Yep. So it really was just immersion and listening to staff and spending time with staff who understood it and just asking a lot of questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I wasn't at the table rolling up my sleeves and writing bills. Not
right.
at that stage. Maybe later on I was uh-huh. a little more... Yeah. involved in that.
So, and you mentioned that the rules on lobbying were a little bit more relaxed
well,
back then.
You know,
so you didn't have to register as a lobbyist.
You did have to register.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, wait a minute. I don't ever remember registering when I was working at Morgan Stanley. Maybe because I didn't trip the then requirement for the amount of time spent in Washington. Now it's pretty strict in
right.
terms of the amount of contacts you have, the amount of time you spend. And we have filed a report twice a year, and we've been doing that since the LDA passed. So I'm trying to remember what it was. I do remember that there were much more relaxed rules about entertaining staff, mm-hmm. and
so you could just call up a staff member and say, "Hey, let me take you out to lunch. I want to talk
yeah,
to you."
Yeah, I'm trying to remember whether bill. There were. I think there were limits on how much you could spend, but they're
right.
pretty generous.
Right. Okay.
So there was a good bit of that, and then the staff were able to travel a lot too, which mm-hmm. a lot of them miss. But and I miss it too. I mean, it's not that I would want to spend that much time at these events and travel, but it was a good way to get to know people, and it's too bad that it's become so stigmatized.
Right. Yeah.
yeah.
Okay. Well, just to go back to a couple of other issues during this period, one important piece of legislation that was passed during this period was the Tax Reform
yeah.
Act of 1986. Did you end up working on that issue at
mm-hmm.
all? Okay.
Yeah, there were a lot of provisions in the 86 Act that affected investment income,
mm-hmm.
clients from Morgan Stanley and Morgan Stanley itself. So I would say, I'm trying to remember, but I think a lot of the work that we did then at Morgan Stanley was in collaboration with the industry. There might have been a couple of provisions that were uniquely important to Morgan Stanley. I can't remember exactly whether we worked on any rifle shot issues from Morgan Stanley, but as an industry, we participated with the industry efforts
mm-hmm. right.
to promote tax reform.
Now, would you often coordinate with the Securities Industry Association?
Yeah.
Would you just have meetings with them and maybe discuss what
issues?
They
still do.
Priorities.
They have government okay. representatives meetings.
Right. Uh-huh.
There are several committees that Morgan Stanley populated. My boss at the time was very active with the regulatory committee.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a New York office, too. So they would have several meetings in New York and a lot of meetings here. They were very active,
mm-hmm.
very active. So we spent a lot of time. And they also had a PAC.
Uh-huh.
Morgan Stanley also had a PAC, so we would try to support their political activities, too.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'm sorry to keep jumping around. I want to go
That's
back
right.
to junk bonds for just one second. Obviously, during the 1980s, there were a number of different scandals in the junk bond industry. I don't believe that any of them involved Morgan Stanley directly, but was this still an issue that you were concerned about?
Well, I mean, as you can see from today's current events, Congress tends to react very strongly to news items, particularly related to bad behavior. So it's very episodic in terms of what Congress chooses to focus on. So when the Drexel situation emerged, this coincided closely with their focus on junk bonds, and then they pounced on efforts to restrict the use of junk bonds. There was also, as you recall, the savings and loan crisis around that time, and there were a lot of concerns in Congress about savings and loans, investment in junk bonds.
Mm-hmm. Now, did Morgan...
So it's all mm-hmm. headline related. And then you right. had the insider trading scandals at some of the firms where,
right.
where now Governor Giuliani then, was he the U.S. attorney then?
Yes.
Handcuffed people and walked them off. So that would be the backdrop for Congress looking at Wall Street. So it's not all that different than today because mm-hmm. you've got these bad incidents that drive behavior here.
Yeah.
And so it was Ivan Boesky and et al. And then it was, the oil mergers. But when there's wrongdoing, as in Boesky and Milken, et cetera, then there's really...
People start to pounce.
Yeah, so. A lot of activity.
Right, yeah. You mentioned the savings and loan crisis. Did Morgan Stanley have any interest in savings and loans?
Well, I'm sure they did. I mean, I'm not sure they had clients involved. I think they participated in some of the RTC work. Mm-hmm. They might have been doing some advisory work for the Resolution Trust Corp. There was
right.
a lot of interest. I don't remember our being tapped for government affairs work too directly.
Right.
During the savings loan. But everyone was affected by that
mm-hmm.
because all the investment banks had financial institutions groups with clients who probably were in distress and
right.
probably helped finance some of the restructuring and
mm-hmm.
were involved in the RTC.
Yep.
That's my guess.
Okay. One final issue that I want to ask you about. One of the big battles, I guess, more generally of this period in the banking industry was efforts to push back against Glass-Steagall, right? Where did Morgan Stanley stand in that debate?
Well, Morgan Stanley was aligned very closely with the SIA, which felt that Glass-Steagall was extremely important to keep in place.
Mm-hmm. As an investment bank, of course. So.
Right. But as a history professor, you'll appreciate this. There was a strong argument to be made for the vitality of the U.S. capital markets being attributed to the fact that we did have this firm separation.
Mm-hmm.
And Morgan Stanley pointed out a lot of concerns about tying and the extent to which commercial banks would tie lending to the ability to do business, the concerns related to the exposure to the insured deposit base to risk-taking activities. So a lot of this is familiar in the context of the recent financial crisis in terms of whether it was appropriate for insured entities to be taking risks with essentially the deposit base and deposit insurance. So the whole argument was really based on: Do you want a segment of the financial world that can take risks with no consequence for taxpayers? And then do you want to have a business that's safer, that doesn't take the risk, that protects the taxpayer base?
Mm-hmm. Sounds familiar.
That was it. That was the fundamental argument. And obviously, Morgan Stanley benefited from the current model, and Morgan Stanley was created by Glass-Steagall because it was a spinoff from J.P. Morgan. So, two partners from J.P. Morgan, Morgan and Stanley, left J.P. Morgan to create Morgan Stanley. So Morgan Stanley was created by Glass-Steagall, so that it was a unique
mm-hmm.
story in that regard.
Right. So that was a core interest of the firm. Right.
But it was a jihad for the securities industry at that time. Because that was the issue for the SIA, was
mm-hmm.
to beat back efforts to repeal it.
Did you find yourself working on specific pieces of legislation during this period?
Well, there were several efforts to, almost every Congress, there were efforts to address Glass-Steagall.
Mm-hmm.
The one that was probably most aggressive was the 1990-91 one, which was pending when I left Morgan Stanley to go to the SEC.
Mm-hmm.
But there were multiple efforts over the years. There was something called, and you may know this, they created a Section 23 affiliate of commercial banks to allow commercial banks to engage in investment banking through this affiliate that was walled off with a firewall, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
That was a big battle to even allow them to have that separate affiliate. So
right.
that was that was a preview of the ultimate effort to repeal Glass-Steagall. So. And that was a big issue.
Yeah. Okay. So in 1991, you moved from Morgan Stanley over to the SEC. Why this move?
Well, my predecessor at the SEC was a friend of mine, Mitch Delk, who had gone from First Boston to the SEC, and I had met him when he was at First Boston when we worked on a few SIA-related matters. And he just put a feeler out to me to gauge whether I'd be interested. And it definitely tapped my interest just because I'd really come to enjoy Washington and was really very immersed in this space. And if you're interested in financial services policy and Washington, the SEC is a pretty attractive spot. Mm-hmm. Although my parents were appalled at the notion of leaving Morgan Stanley because I had just been promoted to vice president and I was happy there. I loved New York, mm-hmm. et cetera. But it was a very appealing opportunity. So Richard Reedon called me and I came down to talk to him. And
did you know him at that time?
No. I knew of him. I mean, he was a prominent figure in our world at that time. And I really didn't know anyone well at the SEC because I'd spent a lot of my time on the Hill. I knew the same Hill people that were working with the SEC. So I came down to talk to him, and it was just a very attractive opportunity for me to be basically his right hand in the context of the Hill. And for the SEC, the legislative affairs position is a really important spot because not only do you manage the legislative issues, but you also manage their appropriation and ensure that they get funded every year, and that's a really big priority. And
What are some of the other differences that working in for a government agency as compared to the private sector?
Well, I mean, the priorities are different, and I think that it's important to point out that there's a very strong sense of mission at the SEC and other government agencies, which is, I think, very admirable. And I think it's easy to convert from representing a client on the private sector side to representing the government and feeling unequivocally committed to your new client, which is basically the U.S. taxpayer, the mission of the agency. And it's a very strong pull. For me, it was. And the SEC has that very strong sense of mission as part of the draw. And I think that people feel that way in the private sector as well, but there's something unique to representing your government and in this case, representing investors and investor interests. And that would be the case in a lot of other government agencies too. There's a lot of career staff who stay there their whole careers. There's also, I think, a healthy mix of people who come in and out, which I support. I mean, I'm all about and support the recusal requirements. And
was it always pretty obvious who was career staff and who was there just for a few years?
Not always. I mean, there's some very talented career staff throughout the government, and we're fortunate they're there. I mean, they have the institutional knowledge. They're willing to work for less money. They feel the sense of mission, I think, motivates them more than if they were supporting a private sector endeavor. So sometimes there's the stereotypical bureaucratic approach that you see, but there's a lot of talented people who are career staff as well, and they help me enormously because I parachute in there. I had no experience there or in Washington really at all. I mean, most people who take those positions have worked on the Hill, and I've worked in and around the Hill, but I had not worked on the Hill.
Was there a steep learning curve?
Not too steep, just because I'd spent all that time at Morgan Stanley at that point. I'd been at Morgan Stanley 8 years when I got there. So fortunately for me, I had good relationships on the Hill that mattered to the SEC. I mean, the key committees for them are the Senate Banking and House, mm-hmm. at that time, House Banking Committee, House Energy and Commerce, actually, before the changeover that pulled securities oversight from the Energy and Commerce Committee, which was then chaired by John Dingell, who really was the most important person at the SEC, and, along with Ed Markey. Mm-hmm. But the appropriations process, brand new to me. Right. I mean, I'd really done very little with appropriations.
Okay.
So this career staff I owe a great debt to because they would come into my office and sit down and say, okay, here's how this works, here's how that works, here's the timing of when we have to focus on different things. And and the amount of testimony that we did was enormous.
Mm-hmm. So that was a major part of your duties, was helping to prepare testimony?
And I couldn't do it. I mean, I had the career staff and the divisions basically prepare the testimony and right. help prepare the chairman or whomever's testifying.
On that note, your title was the Director of the Office of Legislative Affairs, right? Did you have a staff?
I did. I had career staff, actually. Okay. I had a deputy who was really the person who tracked all the correspondence and helped track all the testimony preparation, and then I had someone who worked with him on all the legislative correspondence, and then we had two support staff, and then two women who worked in the chairman's office who did nothing but congressional correspondence, because the volume is just enormous. Mm-hmm. And I wonder whether they have more people now than when I was there, just because the amount of inquiries is just great.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So we were talking about your job duties in general. I guess you helped prepare congressional testimony. You monitored events on the Hill for the SEC. Mm-hmm. You oversaw communications with the Congress. Anything else I'm missing?
Well, the appropriation.
Right,
And the SEC appropriation process had to be completed ideally every year, which wasn't always the case.
Right. And I have some questions for you.
Because it was an independent agency, we dealt with the administration, but not in the formal OMB process, in that we didn't have to get testimony cleared and letters cleared, et cetera, which other cabinet agencies have to do. But we ended up sharing it with them as a courtesy, and they would clear testimony through us from other agencies. So the OMB White House relationship was mostly mine too, mm-hmm. just because the Hill piece was a pretty important piece.
Right. Okay. So probably one of the first issues that you dealt with was Salmon Brothers. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah. That was the summer I arrived.
Right.
And it was pretty dramatic, just because Richard and I had gone up to New York to meet with John Goodfriend that spring or that summer, and we were in his office and chatting away, and we had a tour of the trading floor, and then later when this all blew up, I had to give a deposition about what was discussed because it was so current, mm-hmm. and in the context of their problems.
So just to set the date, it was in August 1991 that it was revealed that Salmon had committed misconduct in regards to the auctions of
government
securities.
Yeah.
Right. So this was right after you got there.
Right.
From your end, what had to be done? You just needed to be in Congress, touch with Congress about
this.
This was not all that
dissimilar to I was remembering this from the recent J.P. Morgan news related to their trading loss. I mean, immediately the committees compete over who is going to get their witness first. So that was one of the things that struck me immediately was, you remember that Warren Buffett was a major investor in Salmon. He became their point person, and he became the person who testified on their behalf during this period. So Senate Banking and House Energy and Commerce fought over who was going to get Buffett first. Yeah. And who was going to get SEC first? Who's going to have the first hearing? So we were in the middle of that, and that was awkward because part of my job was to try to keep the Hill happy with us. Mm-hmm. And I remember we were in the middle. It was just interesting. So the first thing was the Hill wanted, and as often happens, the Hill ends up competing with the SEC on enforcement matters. So if they see a problem, at the time it was Chairman Dingell's Oversight and Investigation Subcommittee, was very aggressive, as you may know, may recall, on many fronts. But they would often shadow what the SEC was doing on certain matters. So they opened their own inquiry into Salmon. They opened inquiries into Drexel. They had their own parallel efforts.
Right.
And that became challenging for the SEC Enforcement Division, mm-hmm. who would come up to me and say, can you do something about this? Because they're asking for the same material we are, et cetera. So,
was there ever a possibility of a joint investigation of this?
No.
No.
They never did anything jointly, but we cooperated with Dingell's staff as well as we could without compromising our own mm-hmm. efforts.
Yeah.
Because unfortunately, you can never be sure of confidentiality, and so they had to be very careful about how much they coordinated with them.
Was the SEC pushing for some new legislation of the government securities market?
Well, yes, there was legislation that was pending at the time this happened, actually. I'm trying to remember. And then this was something that put a fine point on it. the SEC was seeking better disclosure in this government securities space. There was something called an audit trail that they were pushing, and Cantor Fitzgerald was actually involved in this debate because they ended up testifying that they relied on a very antiquated system for tracking the government securities market. And the SEC was supportive of legislation to promote better transparency. And this whole episode, as is often the case, when you have legislation pending and you have an episode that helps to make your case, that's how it panned out. So Richard ended up testifying on government securities several times. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then in conjunction with that, there was some early scrutiny of Fannie and Freddie's involvement as well. And the SEC did produce a report, a joint report, with, I believe, Treasury and the Fed, that called for a few recommendations related to the GSEs that were highly controversial.
But those weren't implemented.
No. But
I wonder why.
Well, they were, as we know, extremely powerful, but it was an early preview of how powerful they really were at pushing back on efforts to reform them or require them. At the time, I think one of the recommendations, and I used to have this report, was to require them to register with the SEC.
Yeah, this is the 1992 joint report on the government securities market,
right.
Just to be specific.
So, yeah. Okay. So there were some specific recommendations in there related to the GSEs, mm-hmm. I think including registering with the SEC, which ultimately, during the most recent round, helped disclose some of the true nature of Fannie and Freddie's issues when they had to disclose to the SEC, because part of that, they didn't have to file anything with the SEC, and they didn't have to use the same accounting requirements. So.
Well, was there any thought of an effort within the SEC to try to push the Congress to pass this legislation, or was it?
No,
I'm laughing just
because I have a vivid memory of Richards testifying on this issue, and Jim Leach, who was chairman of the House Banking Committee at the time, was supportive, and there was a whole set of members who were just ready to pounce, and they did. On Breeden and on Leach for this. So this was, as I said, an early indicator of how powerful the GSEs were at beating back recommendations they didn't support. And so it wasn't one of the issues that I think Richard and Arthur, too, were very good at measuring which issues they could really move mm-hmm. forward. And yeah. I think they realized that that was not going to, well, Richard knew that that wasn't going to bear fruit if the SEC continued to push that, because you obviously need members to sponsor it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So on government securities in general, was there a change on this issue after Arthur Levitt took over? Do you think there was a change?
Well, as I recall, and you may have the timeline, I thought the bill passed while he was there.
I think so.
Ultimately.
I think it was in 93.
It took a while.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
But it wasn't, at that time, for Arthur, it wasn't really a high priority other than just supporting the movement of the bill.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Yeah. So, actually, let me just ask you in general about the differences in personality between Richard Breeden and Arthur Levitt.
Well, they are different. Richard is a trained attorney, so he spent a lot of time in Washington prior to being appointed SEC chairman. He was President Bush's point person on the SNL crisis, so he came in with an enormous amount of background and knowledge about Washington and the process, and about the substantive issues, and particularly related to Glass-Steagall and all the financial reform issues because he had become the expert for President Bush. And his personality as a very knowledgeable, thorough lawyer was extremely detail-oriented. Prior to testifying, he'd be at the office till 1 or 2 in the morning, just poring over the testimony, every word of it, just making sure he felt comfortable with it. And then he'd go home with the briefing book that we'd prepared for him with all the Q&A, and he obviously stayed up reading that because he never got a question he couldn't answer. Oh. Never. He was just extremely thorough and a workhorse who drove us pretty hard, too. But It was always gratifying to know that on the morning of a hearing, he wasn't going to get a question he couldn't answer.
Right.
And he was a perfectionist, too, because he would refine his his words until the very last minute, which was challenging for us because, for me, because the staff wanted the final the night before so they could write questions.
Right.
So it was challenging.
Right.
But it was also very gratifying because it was every hearing was like a final exam.
Was Arthur Levitt a little bit more hands-off?
Well, Arthur was very thorough, too. He was an extremely good manager of people and of his own time. And he was very efficient with his time. And he was very sensitive in terms of being punctual and providing things in a timely manner. And he just, he ran it in a very businesslike way. And I think he brought his business background and his leadership background from having led many major organizations to this position. So it was a different style, and both very effective styles for different reasons.
Right.
And both of them did well on the Hill. I mean, Richard was very well respected for assuming the mission of the age, as was Arthur. He wasn't, neither of them was afraid to take on tough people, tough issues in defense of the agency's mission. I think both of them had that quality. But I think I would say that Arthur was more of a CEO style in terms of how he managed the agency because he'd been a CEO. He'd been head of some major organizations.
Right. Did you notice a big change in tone on the Hill after the 1994 elections?
Yes.
that's an easy question. But
that was,
how did it affect the SEC?
Dramatically, I would say. I mean, I had friends on the Republican side who called me and said, don't expect to get any further increases in your appropriation. And then when fast forward, when all unfortunate things happened at the SEC and some of it was attributed to the lack of resources, I go back to then and say, well, it started a long time ago where there was not a lot of interest in supporting the SEC's appropriation and resources. And I mean, my job changed pretty dramatically just because we'd been dealing with a certain set of leaders who oversaw the SEC, and then you make an abrupt shift to the Republicans, and it was...
Right.
Because John Dingell had been the main person for us for so many years, as was Ed Markey. But fortunately, we had a pretty bipartisan approach to things. So we had good relationships with the Republicans as well, even when they told me they weren't going to increase our budget. So yes, it was very, I thought it was a big deal.
Yeah, I'm going to jump back and ask you about just a couple more issues that you may have worked on during this period. First was efforts to regulate investment advisors. Can you tell me a little bit about how that
Yeah, I mean, I think that was another episodic issue in that there had been a long-standing effort to increase the oversight of investment advisors just because there were so many registered and so few resources from the SEC standpoint to really inspect them often enough, et cetera. So there was an ongoing effort, and then, boom, we had a big enforcement action. Stephen Weimer, who was just a notorious investment advisor who just had a terrible story that made into the press, and that helped make the case for more resources. But it was all a matter of resources. I mean, how do you expect the SEC to inspect the number of investment advisors out there without adequate resources? And so then you end up focusing on the bigger players with assets under management. But some of the worst transgressions are done by the smaller guys who know that they're not as under as much scrutiny.
I think they can fly under the radar.
Yes, that was a big issue, and it was pending at the time when Bill Clinton won the White House, and that was one of the reasons why I wanted to stay, because that was an unfinished effort.
So you thought about leaving after a few?
Well, I mean, you have to think about it just because there's always a possibility of turnover when there's an administration change. The SEC is independent, and you're subject to the call of the chair. There was a transition, and there was some Clinton transition people that we helped, which was interesting, because Richard left pretty soon after the President Clinton was elected. So we had Mary Shapiro was acting chairman, and then we had some transition people in the chairman's office. So they were being briefed up on the SEC and personnel matters, etc.
So it was a little bit unsure for a while.
It's my house.
So was there a moment when, say, Arthur Levitt called and asked if you wanted to stay on?
Well, I was fortunate to work with him right off the bat on his confirmation, which was, it's a very intense time to get to know someone, and I had an offer to go back to Morgan Stanley, but he asked me to stay on with him, and I was happy to do it just because I'd only been there 18 months at that point, and I really was enjoying the job, and so I was very happy to stay. And then I also knew the head of President Clinton's legislative office, Howard Pastor, very well, and he had been a mentor of mine because he had been with Timmons & Company, which was Morgan Stanley's lobbying firm, and he called to ask if I was happy and wanted to stay because even though the SEC is independent, it's helpful to have the White House support. Okay. So I was very fortunate, and I was happy to stay because I'd only been there a short time.
All right. Okay. All right. So I want to ask you about just a couple other issues before we move on. So another big issue during this period was the supervision of municipal bonds.
Mm.
We talked a little bit about that, but did you work very closely with the Congress on that issue?
Well, this was a major priority of Arthur's right at the beginning of his term. I think just because he'd seen some pretty serious abuses in his prior life. And this became a real cause of his early on in his tenure, and he created that Office of Municipal Securities at the SEC to focus attention on it, and he really championed the effort to crack down on pay-to-play. So that was an area of interest for Congress, but that was really Arthur's
personal issue. Yeah.
And there was a lot that he did as chairman to push that didn't really require Congress.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately it did, but it wasn't a tough sell. I mean, it wasn't one of those things where we had to convince people just because there were some pretty serious abuses.
Right.
And he had this exposure to it, and so he came in with this desire to really change the way it was done, and it was a great example of his bringing his prior experience to the table.
Okay. Another issue was, I guess, the ongoing efforts to repeal Glass-Steagall. It obviously didn't happen while you were there, but there were a number of efforts to pass bills that would have pushed back this barrier. Where did the SEC stand on that? Were they supportive of it? Or was there division?
This was a challenge because it was a priority of the Clinton administration. And I'm trying to remember. I mean, Arthur was skilled at getting along with everyone.
Mm-hmm. So you think there was a little bit of finessing of the issue going on?
Well, I sensed a change in tone than it might have been 10 years prior, just because things had evolved and priorities were shifting. And I don't remember it being a big priority of Arthur's.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember it. I don't remember his raising it as we've got to support the administration on this. And I'm also trying to recall, what was the year that it was enacted?
Well, it was finally enacted in 1999 with Graham Leach Bliley.
Yeah.
You had already left by then.
So really, Graham Leach Bliley became was a major priority after I left. So I left in 96.
Right. So that was before
so
that.
So it really hadn't. So prior to that, prior to Graham Leach Bliley, it really wasn't a hot topic for Arthur.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
As far as I can recall.
All right. Okay. One last area that I wanted to ask you about. You've already mentioned it a couple of times, but appropriations. Obviously, there were a number of battles fought during this period over the SEC budget. Tell me a little bit about this notion of self-funding that was coming into play at this time.
Well, this was a major priority for Richard just because I think he had seen some of this prior to coming to the SEC. The SEC at the time, and I'm not familiar with how their fees work now and how much they generate in the surplus, but with a booming economy and booming number of deals, the SEC takes in a lot of fee revenue that's way more than they use to fund the agency. So this surplus goes to OMB And Richard, you say they use it for funding bee farms. I mean, it used to just really upset him that this enormous amount of money was going toward things completely unrelated to the SEC. And,
right.
But enforcement disgorgement was different. So enforcement fines was in a separate account.
Mm-hmm. So this
that really wasn't the issue. The issue was really the fees, the corporation finance fees that came in for filings
mm-hmm.
and for M&A filings.
Yeah. Because one of the criticisms of this idea of self-funding was that, well, the SEC is going to be much harsher on enforcement because they're going to try to get these disgorgement penalties or whatever.
Well, it did become a real issue for some members who were concerned that the SEC wouldn't be subject to the discipline of the appropriations process, to your point. So to the extent that you become self-funded, you become less accountable to Congress, yes, because you're not dependent on them for an appropriation. However, one could counter-argue that it's probably a good thing for the SEC to be immune to political winds, as in you're not going to get a call in 1994 and say we're going to bleed you dry in terms of your appropriation.
Right.
But
the Congress had other controls too.
But there were some pretty powerful members who were very concerned about keeping a check on the SEC. So that I think ultimately undermined a self-funding effort. But at one time, I think it was 94,
mm-hmm.
95. There came a point where certain members wanted to call attention to this situation by raising a point of order on the SEC's appropriation, just because the fees could be construed as a tax, because, and this is relevant right now, because the definition of a tax is a fee becomes a tax when the revenue raised is not used to fund the effort that the fee was charged for. So a point of order was raised on the SEC's appropriations in the fall of 95,
mm-hmm.
and the appropriations was threatened at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to reach a resolution on it, so it came to a head.
Right, yeah. And I think there was an issue.
This was after Richard.
Right.
This was during Arthur's tenure.
There was also another issue, I believe, in 1994 when there was a battle over the appropriations bill and President Clinton threatened to shut down the organization if it wasn't adequately funded.
That was the
same time. Okay, yeah. So it may have been in 94. It was in that time period in any case. So,
There are different times where the SEC's appropriation has gotten some attention. That fall of 95 when the point of order was raised, it was basically a exercise to make a point, but it did stop the SEC from getting their appropriations
mm-hmm.
for a while.
Would you say that the majority of staff members and maybe commissioners at the time supported self-funding, or were there some that?
I think there was a lot of support at the agency for it, just because it's always a challenge to wonder every year what the SEC is going to appropriate, and whether there'll be some holdback based on something completely unrelated because a member is upset about something.
Right.
And there was also this very keen awareness for how much the SEC was contributing to the federal bottom line, and they weren't getting anything for it.
Right.
So I would say, yes, there was a lot of support. Linda Quinn was head of corporation finance at the time under Breeden and Arthur, and she was very supportive.
Yep. Another major issue from this period was the issue of litigation reform, quote-unquote. What was the SEC's take on that?
Well, it is still a very controversial issue. And historically, the SEC took the position that it was important for investors to have significant ability to bring cases to supplement the SEC's efforts, because the SEC has limited resources.
Right.
So the notion that an investor can threaten a case was viewed to be an important check on behavior, actually,
mm-hmm.
and as an important way to supplement the SEC's resources. So historically, the SEC had been very supportive of investor rights to redress their grievances through the courts.
Okay.
But there were some abuses, as there often are, on behalf of investors, and investor lawsuits became quite aggressive and prevalent in certain sectors. And certain law firms became well known for filing lawsuits as soon as a stock dropped, and they would have boilerplate complaints that they would just change the names of the firms and just file the complaint.
So do you think this was there was certainly this perception out there that many law firms were just ready to pursue as soon as the stock dropped?
Right.
Yeah. Do you think that's a fair perception?
As soon as their stock dropped, sometimes. There were cases, and they were good at describing them, where they would be tracking the buying and selling behavior of senior officials, and they would demonstrate that a senior official dumped a bunch of stock before a bad announcement, and investors obviously aren't privy to the announcement. So there were some good points to be made, and they were very good at it. Mm-hmm. They would often come up to the Hill and testify with timelines, and but you can imagine that the firms that were the victims of the lawsuits felt very besieged and beleaguered, and thought it was a real drag on their growth. And so they had some strong support on the Hill. Mm-hmm. Another very strong voice on this was the accounting firms, because in our system there's joint and several liability. And so in the context of securities litigation, as is often the case, if a firm has been sued and it doesn't have the resources, the other entities involved in the case, and in this case often it's the accounting firms who verified the veracity of the financial information, they're joint and severally liable too. So the accounting firms would end up being the last people standing with deep pockets and end up having to... Mm-hmm. Pay a great deal. And so the accounting firms are making the case that their viability was undermined by this process. So they were very aggressively seeking reform as well. But then the counter to that is, but you guys should verify the numbers. I mean, you have a very important role in this system.
Right.
That basically audited financials are required for a firm to go public.
Mm-hmm.
So the auditors have this incredibly important role in our system.
Right.
So that's the counter. It's like, well, you guys have to do a better job. The argument would go.
Right.
But their argument would be, well, right. But if these guys give us the wrong numbers or the wrong information, how can we be sure of what they're getting? So they had some very serious arguments, and I think probably their strongest is that we all have an interest in a very strong auditing profession, and the fact that they were subject to these enormous dollars for these lawsuits was pretty significant. And then you had the Silicon Valley community who were very politically active, who were particularly focused on forward-looking statements. So the new startups were very concerned about being sued for the predictions they would make about their futures.
So what impact did the 1994 elections have on all this? Do you think that was sort of an impetus for...
I think that helped, because if the House flipping to the Republicans helped promote the case of the defendant community.
Right.
And this became a pretty strong priority and I believe it might have even been in the Contract with America.
Mm-hmm.
Litigation reform, I think it was.
I think it might have been, too.
So at the time, Chris Cox was a pretty strong proponent of this, later SEC chairman.
Mm-hmm.
And inside the building, in the SEC building, there was some pretty strong divisions about this. And some commissioners were more supportive of reform than others.
Right.
So the enforcement division, as you might expect, was supportive of investors' ability to bring cases.
Right. But at the end of the day,
it was quite a mm-hmm. spirited debate.
Right. But at the end of the day, the legislation was passed, right, in 1995?
And vetoed by President Clinton. It was the only veto that was overridden.
Okay. Yeah.
I think my personal opinion was that President Clinton was right to veto the bill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you think the commissioner, most of the commissioners at the SEC agreed? Arthur Levitt, for instance?
I think I don't want to put words in Arthur's mouth.
Right.
I don't know
okay.
in retrospect what he would say about it now.
Okay.
He was supportive of trying to strike a balance, and that was, I think, what everyone was trying to do, is just how do you get that balance without undermining investors' ability to And, as I said at the outset, how is it changing behavior? Because at the end of the day, you want to have a check on bad behavior. Mm-hmm. And the risk of litigation is usually a good check on that.
Right.
But some of the things that happened subsequent to it, like Enron, I think put a fine point on why the legislation may not have been. And I'm trying to think of what some of the key pieces of it were. That, and I should read President Clinton's veto message again for what motivated him. But they took a very thoughtful approach to it.
Uh-huh.
He had been a law professor. He read it himself. And his counsel was calling us all the time and asking us questions. So this wasn't just a political exercise for him. He really got into the weeds on it.
Okay.
It was an interesting process.
Yep. So at the beginning of 1996, you moved on from the SEC to the General Electric Company. Will you tell me a little bit about your work there?
I started with GE in the Washington office, and I was technically an employee of GE Capital, but the GE Washington office was a very collaborative office, and so while I wore the GE Capital hat, it was all about GE as a corporate entity, and so everyone worked really closely together. And I was the point of financial issues, but there was a very strong sense, as you might expect with GE, of teamwork. And the head of the office at the time was really good at promoting that kind of collaborative approach. So for me, it was a great opportunity to learn about a lot of other issues. The team ended up helping me with my issues because we had, at the time, Democratic and Republican specialists. So they had relationships that were really important to my work,
mm-hmm.
Even though they might not be the substantive expert.
Yeah.
So it was a great setup for
okay.
me.
What sorts of issues were you working on during these years?
Well, GE had a lot of consumer finance issues.
Uh-huh.
So from the outset, there were some pretty significant credit card issues, which ended up being an issue the whole time I was there for different reasons. I remember not long after I started, GE announced it was going to charge a fee for people who carried a balance. I'm sorry, for people who didn't carry a balance. So you can see why the quantitative people might have thought that was a good idea because they weren't making money from people who paid off their balance. But here it was very explosive because you're basically penalizing people for behaving responsibly. It was quite a firestorm. And I remember Congressman Kennedy, Joe Kennedy, really pounced on GE for this.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of times you felt like you had to sort of defend the company policy. Or something.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think, but to GE's credit, they realized the error quickly and withdrew it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was an interesting exercise.
Right.
And an early preview of some of the hostility toward credit card practices,
mm-hmm.
which just escalated over the years.
Right.
Another major issue at the time was all about mortgage finance,
uh-huh.
Because GE had a mortgage insurance company at the time. This was 96, so they were very concerned about the GSEs and the competitive pressures that they were feeling from them. And
so they saw the GSEs as competitors. So.
Well, they were a partner, and the GSEs charter basically created mortgage insurance because they weren't able to purchase mortgages with less than 20% down. Down payment without mortgage insurance. So it was an important synergistic relationship. But what became a concern for GE and other mortgage insurers was the threat that the GSEs would want to provide their own mortgage insurance, which is what happened in 1998. Freddie inserted some language into their appropriations bill in the handwriting, in the margin, that would have allowed them to self-insure, which set off enormous concerns, not just with the mortgage insurance community, but with the rest of the mortgage community, because if they're willing to take on mortgage insurance, then what's next? And what became clear was that the GSEs wanted to be a one-stop shop for all things related to mortgage finance.
Right.
So that's what gave rise to FM Watch, the whole effort to start to question the GSE's advantages.
Mm-hmm. And that was supported by the rest of the...
GE was a very strong proponent of this at the outset, and the others were AIG, Wells Fargo, Chase Mortgage. But it was very controversial. As we discussed earlier, the GSEs were very powerful here. And it was, but it was a matter of, at the time, that language in the margin was beaten back, not easily, but there was obviously a process breach that they'd been able to put it in the dark of night.
Mm-hmm.
The publicly traded mortgage insurers tanked the next day because you could see immediately the impact. If they could self-insure, then the private sector mortgage insurers couldn't compete price-wise because you have a government-subsidized pricing model, and they'll always underprice.
Right.
So it would have put the MIs out of business. Now, GE had a significant business, but it wasn't their whole business. Whereas the independent, publicly traded mortgage insurers, their stocks plummeted the next day. So it
was forever. It was a competitive issue.
It was a scramble,
right?
And it was undone. But the experience was quite formative for everyone involved because it became clear that an effort had to be undertaken to try to contain them.
Right. Okay.
So that was a major area of.
Right.
And then aviation finance was also a big area of interest.
Okay, tell me about that. I'm not.
Well, GE and AIG were the two largest aircraft leasing companies. And I think GE still is one of the largest. And since AIG's troubles during the financial crisis, I don't know what's happened to their aircraft leasing business.
I think they still have the business. To my knowledge, I could be wrong about that.
But GE and AIG were one and two.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, I think GE owned one out of every eight aircraft in the world. So there was a lot of financial issues related to aircraft leasing. And then after 9/11, it became a very high priority because you may recall that immediately after the tragedy, there was a lot of concern and questions about terrorism insurance. And the weekend after 9/11, GE was faced with having to ground their entire fleet of aircraft because they couldn't be assured of having insurance to cover them in the event of another terrorist attack. So, and then there were lots of tax issues at GE, too.
Right.
And that was one of the team issues that I worked on. And one of the most important for GE Capital was deferral, so-called subpart F, which is still topical because it's been an extender over the years. And it basically allows U.S. financial firms to defer the U.S. tax owed on active financial services income derived from overseas operations until it's repatriated.
Okay.
Huge issue for GE Capital as a global entity and for others, too, competitively.
Right.
So we worked a lot on that initially because that was when it was first enacted. So that was a major issue for GE Capital, but also for GE Corporate Tax. So that was an issue that we all worked on together. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I hate to move on, but I know this was a 10-year period, and there was a lot that happened. 11-year period, excuse me. A lot that happened there.
Yeah.
But, The next stage of your career was very interesting, too. You moved to Barclays Capital, where you were the director of government relations. You started at the beginning of 2007, right as the financial crisis was breaking out. Tell me, did Barclays have a general strategy towards, government relations management during this period?
Well, Barclays Bank had someone here for a long time, whom I joined. So they had one person here. And it was interesting to come from an iconic American company to a foreign entity. Very different, because you're treated differently.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even though you employ a lot of Americans, if you're not a U.S. flag company, it's a different relationship.
You're the overseas branch that doesn't necessarily get
you're an overseas parent. You're not a U.S. flag company, so it's just different. It's not like you're building appliances in Louisville, you know. So it's not like you're not perceived as an American constituent as much.
Right. So you were treated a little bit differently on the
hill. Oh yeah.
To talk to people.
But, but you're still bringing U.S. employees to the table. You're bringing expertise. Barclays was part of it. It had become SIA had become SIFMA. And at the time, they had Barclays Global Investors as well, so they had an asset management business. Mm-hmm. They had a mortgage platform, so given my experience with mortgage issues, I spent a lot of time on that as the crisis unfolded, which was unfortunate but interesting.
Right.
They also had a pretty robust commodities business. Mm-hmm. And as just happened recently, there was a lot of focus on the impact of Wall Street on energy prices. So uh-huh. that was an interesting exercise.
Okay. Did you also work on the issue of special purpose entities? Was that
yes. something that you were working yeah. on? Yeah, there was during the crisis, there was some interest in creating some SPEs, and Barclays was involved in uh-huh. discussing with Treasury some different options. Yeah.
Okay.
It was interesting.
And then, of course, the giant issue during this period was the acquisition of Lehman Brothers.
Yeah, which was not something we were involved in at all.
Oh, really? Okay.
No, I mean, I think that was a very important strategic call for Barclays Capital and mm-hmm. Really catapulted Barclays as an investment banking entity once they were able to acquire Lehman's best assets, which yeah. is really what that was. And so we, my colleague at Barclays and I, moved into Lehman's Washington office, and it contracted a good bit. They'd had a lot of research people here, which they decided to exit that space. And they had a pretty sophisticated operation, Lehman did. And I'd worked with them a lot over the years, so mm-hmm. they had a very good reputation yeah. in Washington. Yeah.
So when I guess the Barclays upper management was dealing with the U.S. government, they were doing that personally and not through the
yeah. I mean that was
office,
as you
right?
had seen. Yeah. I mean uh-huh. that it has read some of the books during that period.
Absolutely.
It was these were very high level conversations.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And then in June 2009, you moved over to H&R Block, which was another change too,
yeah.
right? What issues was H&R Block?
Well, Richard Breeden recruited me,
okay.
my old boss at the SEC. His equity firm had a significant stake in Block, and they had, I think it's fair to say, rescued Block from bankruptcy a couple years prior, because Block had gotten into subprime mortgages in a significant way and had done very well and then suffered the way a lot of other people did. So Richard asked me to help in the Washington office and asked me to take over the office. And at the time, they were particularly concerned about President Obama's interest in simplifying the tax return, particularly for low-income taxpayers, to the point where the IRS would basically prepare your return for you and send it to you. Mm-hmm. And H&R Block and Jackson Hewitt and other tax preparers, that's their core business. So this was basically a survival issue for H&R Block because... I think that, and this was an Austin Goolsbee idea, who had been close to the president and was one of his chief economic advisors, and he was really pushing this mm-hmm. as an efficiency move, both for the IRS and also from their perspective, they thought it was a fairness issue for this particular taxpayer.
Mm-hmm.
So the average income of H&R Block's customer is $35,000. So this was squarely hitting at the heart of Block's business model.
Right.
So that was a pretty high priority right out of the box to collaborate with others to make the case that it's really not in the taxpayer's interest to have the government prepare your return.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think the chief argument you would make is, do you really think the government wants to maximize your refund? Whereas Block is, they're all about trying to find the most possible for you, obviously legally, that you're entitled to.
Right.
And so you have that, and then you have the conservative, you tap the conservative nerve when you have the IRS expanding in that fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's a resources issue, too. I mean, in order for the IRS to do this, it would take an enormous amount of resources to create the systems required for that.
Right.
So that was a high priority.
Tech software, filing something, all those things.
So that was a very high priority. And then around the same time, the IRS initiated an effort to oversee tax preparers, which Block actually welcomed, because every tax season, Block, who trains their people very thoroughly and tests them and regularly tests them, were competing against people who hung out shingles and then disappeared. So... Block was supportive of an effort to elevate the standards of tax preparers. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of discussions about testing and whether Block's test would be acceptable and certification. And so while Block supported it, they were also concerned that there was an additional layer on top of what they required of their people. So there's a lot of coordination going on with that. And then one of the major issues was refund anticipation loans, mm-hmm. which the Obama administration was very opposed to generally. And it's controversial in that they're high interest rate loans.
Was Block actually giving these loans out themselves? Or
they had a partner. Right. They couldn't. They could have if they were allowed because they had a bank. They had a thrift. But the IRS prohibited them, mm-hmm. which is unfortunate because I'm convinced that if Block had been able to offer RALs on its own, they could have kept the rate lower. Because for Block, the long-term customer relationship of the tax prep is more important. I mean, the RALs an important piece of it, mm-hmm. but they want to keep that tax prep customer for a long time.
Right.
So they would have an interest, I think, in keeping the RAL rate reasonable. But the IRS would never allow it because, from their perspective, they didn't want the customer to feel compelled to do the tax prep just because the RAL was offered. So it was controversial. And then because there was a reliance on an outside bank, Block and others who had the same situation were not as influential in determining what the rates were. And there's a lot of focus on this in the States, and it was viewed as a predatory loan. The maximum that could be charged was 36%, which is a high rate, but it's a short-term loan. And they're extremely popular at this income level because in the first part of the year, it's probably the most important financial transaction of the whole year for this community. And this community is largely unbanked. So Block because they had a bank, they pioneered this effort to load refunds onto a debit card, uh-huh. and it was very popular. And in fact, I think Treasury's been talking more to Block and others about the debit card mm-hmm. Loading approach for refunds.
Okay.
But there was a visceral reaction to RALs, mm-hmm. Which was, I can understand it, but I came to appreciate how important that transaction was for this community.
Yeah.
So right before I left, there was a pretty concerted effort to crack down on RALs across the administration, and basically the OCC prohibited Block's partner from offering them,
okay.
HSBC. So they're no longer able to offer them.
Did Block take a position on reforming the general oversight of consumer finance?
Well, I think there was an expectation the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau under Dodd-Frank would likely focus on refund loans and refund checks, and that's, I think, just something we tracked because we knew it would be on their list, but we didn't lobby
against
the CFPB, no.
Okay.
No.
Right.
And then Block also had a tax institute, and this was basically the think tank at Block to help track tax developments for their clients. So we helped, the Tax Institute reported to me, so it was a good way for us to interact with the Hill about the implications of different changes in the code, delays with different extenders. So that was interesting, too, because it was a very substantive part of the job to understand how some of these changes that may or may not be made at the end of the year as we're facing mm-hmm. this year, it's really hard for consumers to understand how it's going to affect their tax return. So Block has this whole group of people who do nothing but keep track of all the changes in the code or the pending changes or the changes that won't be made or will be retroactive. It's very complicated. So that they can help their tax preparers answer questions for their clients.
Okay.
It's it really gives you an appreciation for how complex the code is and how hard it is to track changes. And I can just imagine what they're contemplating for this year with all the pending expirations of the Bush tax cuts and what happens if they get extended or not, and if they expire, is there going to be a retroactive application? So on the one hand, it's a positive for tax preparers because you really need help. On the other hand, though, it's extremely hard to track.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it was very educational for me, that whole experience, because of the fact that I was focused on an entirely different
area
and economic group.
Right.
I mean, this community is really underserved.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So this gets us up to the beginning of last year when you came over to BlackRock, where you are now the Managing Director of Congressional Relations.
Mm-hmm.
And what are you working on right now?
Well, I guess I should start by saying I was introduced to BlackRock by my former boss at Barclays, who came to BlackRock when Barclays Global Investors was acquired mm-hmm. by BlackRock. So I was very fortunate to have that introduction. BlackRock is an asset manager. It's all about investors and the investor voice. We're not a broker-dealer. We never did proprietary trading. And I think that during and after the financial crisis, BlackRock realized that investor needed a bigger seat at the table, particularly when it came to looking at some of these mortgage issues and the role of mortgage securitization, and the voice of the investor did not register well enough from BlackRock's perspective and others. So that motivated BlackRock to be more involved here. So my boss is a founding partner of BlackRock, Barbara mm-hmm. Novick. She had run the global client group, and Larry Fink asked her to oversee this operation. And we have people in Brussels and London as well, because we're obviously global and all these issues intersect all the time, more than ever in terms of how decisions here or in Brussels or in London affect all mm-hmm. of our businesses. So we try really hard to coordinate. So
legislation globally.
It's all about Dodd-Frank implementation. It's really been the focus for the last 18 months that I've been here. I mean, the Hill relationships are still really important.
Mm-hmm.
And even though Congress hasn't been really focused on specific legislation, they're playing an important oversight role with Dodd-Frank implementation, so we spent a good amount of time with the Hill as well, trying to be a good resource, technical resource.
Okay.
We've done a lot of papers on a whole variety of issues, so we try to think of ourselves as a very reliable, substantive resource on all these issues. But also for BlackRock itself, we've been very aggressively mm-hmm. advocating the investor perspective on some of these issues, mm-hmm. and I think we've gotten some good traction.
Do you find you get calls from say, staffers on the Hill asking you to help explain an issue just because of your expertise?
They do.
I see that on your website. You have lots of
we have a lot of public policy
like
papers uh-huh. and comment letters. And, yeah, I mean, and that's what we welcome. And we want people to view us as a resource. We're obviously an advocate as well because we have a point of view and we want to make sure our interests are addressed. But I think we've established ourselves as a very reliable technical resource.
Okay. I just have a couple of final little questions for you. Some people compare the process of making laws to making sausage. You know, a bunch of different things is thrown in a blender, and what comes out is what it is. Do you think that's a fair assessment, or do you think that most legislation on financial issues actually has a pretty sound basis? That's a bit of an abstract question. But.
Well, I mean, it sounds very pejorative to call it sausage. I happen to really like sausage. I think a lot of people like sausage. There's healthy sausage, not so healthy sausage. So if you want to use a sausage analogy, it's fair. Sometimes the process isn't pretty. Oftentimes it's not. But I still believe in the system. I think it's a frustrating system. It can be a lengthy system. But I think it's fair. I think it's transparent. I think there are abundant chances to influence the system as a citizen, as an interest. And I think despite the process that can look a little awkward from the outside and the inside, I do think that I think the process is a good process, mm-hmm. especially when we compare it to other countries and other systems. It can be painfully slow. It can also be incredibly fast sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Not often. But I think the way the Senate and House are set up is so different, and I'm not sure the framers realized how helpful it is to have such different rules. But I think that offers more opportunity to influence things in a positive way. I do think there could be some changes contemplated in the Senate. For instance, do you really need 60 votes? I mean, I think a majority would probably be fair. And that used to be the way it was. So you can change that. Mm-hmm. But I hear a lot of people complaining, and we hear that a lot. But I'm optimistic that the foundation's in place for us to get serious again soon. And hopefully there'll be enough of an incentive to make some deals on some really important issues in our immediate future, particularly the deficit, which makes all of the other issues pale in comparison, in my view.
One more big abstract question. Do you ever find yourself thinking that you're dealing with the same issues year after year in different form?
They're similar, but no year is ever the same, which is why this is such an interesting job. First of all, you have a turnover here every 2 years of people. And while there is a consistent strain of people who live through elections and populate the agencies in the Hill, there's still enough turnover to refresh every 2 years, which is really makes it interesting. And you have to get to know new people. And with a new administration, that's obviously the case in spades, because all the agencies turn over, all the staff. So it's really important to make sure you maintain relationships and stay close to what's going on. And I think, as we were saying earlier, the fact that I worked on a lot of these issues when I was 22 and a lot of them are still with us gives me some great perspective on how these issues have evolved. So that's been really healthy. And my grandfather was a trial lawyer representing insurance companies, and he worked deep into his 80s, and his hearing was failing. And I often think about a judge pulling him aside one day when he was a lot older and said to him, "Dave, I don't think you're hearing me out there during the proceedings." He said, "Your Honor, I've heard it all before." So I think about that a lot. I've seen a lot. A lot of these cycles are similar, but there's enough difference in terms of personnel and priorities and context that really keep it interesting.
Okay. Well, I think that's a great note to end on. Ms. Fulton, thanks very much for talking with me today.
Delighted.